Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 310, recorded Monday, August 14th, 2017. Walt Mossberg. Triangulation is brought to you by WordPress. Your customers want to find you. Build a WordPress.com website and help them connect with your business. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in tech and talk about, well, whatever the heck they want to. And today, I am honored and thrilled to recognize the Dean of American Tech Writing, the father of us all, Walt Mossberg, who since 1991 wrote, well, it started in 1991, writing the personal tech column for the Wall Street Journal, called alternately the Scourge of Silicon Valley. Uh-huh. And the man who could make a product or break a product. I think Ken Alotta had a great, I'll have to find his phrase for you in the New Yorker, but he had a great phrase for the power of Walt Mossberg. Walt, welcome to Triangulation. I feel like I've known you my whole life, and we've never met, so I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Well, I've known you. I mean, you know, I've been an admirer of your work. We just, for some reason, we've never met.
We all are in the shadow of Walt Mossberg. So, I think everybody knows this, but just a quick recap. You know, Wall Street Journal for many years created the Code Conference with Wall Street Journal. All Things D eventually spun that off. You and Kara spun it off to your own business, Kara Swisher, and then sold to Vox. And then in June, you shocked us all by saying, "This is my last column."
Well, I actually in April announced that I would be doing my last column in shortly after the Code Conference, which ends in June, and that's what happened. I am now retired for a huge 5 weeks. I have 5 weeks of retirement under my belt, so I am a retirement expert. My idea of retiring was really, and I explain this in the post, to reinvent myself, which is something I've done, as you just pointed out, a number of times in my career. Got to remember, I started off covering and spent 20 years covering Washington policy and politics before I ever started being a tech writer. And so there have been a number of reinventions, and I just think of this as another one. You know, I'm not doing things on a weekly or daily cadence anymore, but I'm writing a book. I'm involved in a kind of crusade for news literacy, which we can talk about if you want. And I have some other things up my sleeve, which I'm probably not going to talk about.
So I won't say how has retirement been then. It sounds like you're not really particularly retired.
Well, I am retired. I mean, I don't.
You're not raising squashes out in the back or anything.
No. I'm not doing that. And I'm not spending a lot of time lying on the hammock. But I have actually spent more time with my family in the last 5 weeks than in the previous, I don't know, 5 years or something, which is great. And I'm going to continue doing that and doing some travel and some speaking. But you're right. I'm not living in Boca on the beach. I mean, I am working on a book and these other things.
You wielded and probably continue to wield immense power in Silicon Valley. I found Ken Auletta's quote from his New Yorker profile of you in 2007. He said, "Walt Mossberg is someone whose judgment can ratify years of effort or sink the show." Did that power ever concern you? How did that feel to you personally?
Well, it never felt as dramatic as Ken Auletta made it sound.
but Walt, it was true. I mean, People came to you and wanted your seal of approval, and you know, without it, it was tough.
No, well, there are plenty of things that succeeded that I thought were suboptimal, and there were some things I liked a lot that didn't succeed.
What did you hate? Tell me something.
Very much. Wait, before we get to that, yeah, I mean, okay. The analogy, the correct analogy, the way to think about it is, you know, I decided in 91 to be kind of a movie critic for tech products or a book reviewer for tech products. So, and I had a big platform, which was the Wall Street Journal. And so just like a movie critic or a book reviewer, there are things you will like, you will praise, but which go on to, you know, not sell in big numbers. There are things you will say, geez, this is really lousy or, you know, not as good as six other things, yeah. But the public will buy them anyway. And that never bothered me. I was not interested in driving sales or hurting sales. It did happen. You know, you mentioned Ken Auletta, who is a New Yorker media writer who very well known, who did that piece. But Wired did a piece on me also. And at that time, they did a chart. And I had never paid any attention to this, but they did a chart kind of showing, I can't remember whether the sales or stock prices or something.
They called you the kingmaker.
Yeah, they did. But their interesting thing was they had this chart that showed, you know, a certain product I had reviewed and what happened to their sales or their stock following the review, positive or negative. So, you know, people paid attention to that. But I really, honest to God, I know it sounds corny, but I really was just trying to give my opinion in a way that would help average people because I thought, and this is really the reason I started the column, I thought the industry was not aiming its efforts at average people and instead was really aiming its efforts at techies and enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be the champion of average people, and that's what I was right to the end.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely the key to the success, your success. You wrote for people who weren't necessarily tech enthusiasts when you compare that with all the blogs that have come out since. And, you know, Peter, there's a quote, Peter Rojas saying, we, Engadget, we aimed at the tech enthusiast.
Yeah, which is great, which is fine. Yeah. I mean, you make up your mind in media, and you've done this also. Everyone has. Actually, I would say it goes beyond media. It goes to anything you do. You make up your mind, who is your audience? Yeah. Who is your customer base if you're a business? And you try to be laser focused on that. And I made up my mind that my customer base was smart people. They weren't idiots. They weren't computer phobic necessarily, but they had about as much interest in how the computer worked as they did in knowing, you know, how to tweak the engine in their car. You know, there's a percentage of people who are car enthusiasts. There are magazines and websites and podcasts and things aimed at them. And God bless it. I think it's great. But 95% of the people that drive and buy cars don't care. They're a lot more interested in how does it look? Where are the cup holders? Is it convenient? Is it safe? Whatever, you know. And so they have a different set of criteria. And it was similar to me in the way I approached tech.
Well, that's one thing that also changed from when you started covering tech in 91 to today. In 91, it maybe was a field that was, you know, mostly enthusiasts wanted to read about it. Did you have a hard time convincing the Journal that it needed a weekly tech column?
I didn't know that I had a hard time convincing the Journal, but it turned out I did. And so what happened was I went to the top editor, which at the Journal at the time was called the managing editor, a guy named Norm Perlstein.
An old friend. You'd worked with him in Detroit.
An old friend, yeah. And I was at that time, I had a very good beat, very good job at the Journal. I was the national security reporter. My job was to cover essentially the end of the Cold War and some related things, the intelligence community and eventually the Gulf War, the war in Kuwait. But primarily it was U.S.-Soviet relations and the end of the Cold War. And I went to him and I said, look, I know I have this great job, but I don't want to do it anymore. I have this other idea. I want to write this computer and technology column, and I want it to be the inverse of what all the other columns are that are around, which is I don't want to write for geeks in geek language. I want to write for normal people, and I want to take the industry to task rather than be reverential about it, even though the industry, of course, the big companies in the tech industry were advertisers in the Journal. And Perlstein loved the idea. I mean, he thought it was a great idea, but he asked me to wait a year because there was just too much going on my beat. And I did wait a year. But what I didn't realize is that after that year, when I said to him, okay, you said to wait a year, now I want to do the column, it turned out he had to fight a big battle internally about having this column.
Yeah. This is right about when I started doing full-time Tech Talk Radio, and it was very similar. I think it was not – it was at the time, it was foreign language programming. It was something mainstream people thought, oh, nobody wants to read this. But boy, were they wrong. The first line of your first column, 1991, is computers are too hard to use, and it's not your fault. And I think that set the tone right from the start.
Yeah. Well, that was my intention. Part of it was to put the industry on notice that this column was going to be about really making it somehow sending a memo that this stuff needed to be usable by average people without a lot of tinkering. Now, you have to understand, I'd been a hobbyist for 10 years before this, and I'd never taken computer science. I knew nothing about it. I just got entranced by it, and so I had to learn, and it was hard to learn. So part of the line was to say to the industry, look, who all read the Wall Street Journal, was to say to them, look, you need to do better. And the second half of the line was kind of guilt relief for readers.
Right.
You're not stupid.
Right.
Leo, you remember very well, just as I do, that in 1991, and actually for a long time after that, well into the 2000s, people who, whether it was a computer or another digital product, who couldn't make it work or ran into some problem, tended to blame themselves. Whereas if their refrigerator didn't work or their TV didn't work, they blamed the manufacturer or the store where they bought it. They didn't think they were stupid. But with regard to digital products and computers in particular, they regarded themselves as stupid. So the it's not your fault part was my saying, look, you're not stupid. These guys who are making it are not making it with an aim to make it usable by you.
Yeah. Yeah, it actually ended up being the mantra for the show we started doing in 1998 on Tech TV called Call for Help. It's not your fault.
Right.
Because even then, people still blamed themselves. I think today people blame themselves if they can't use an iPhone. They say, well, that's something wrong with me because everybody else seems to be using it.
Yeah.
And it's still not your fault, I think.
No, it's not. Yeah. And it's much less than it was then. You know, one of the things that has happened, and I'm certainly not taking credit for it. I assume you're not taking credit for it either. But I think people like us and others helped a little, which is the computer that you couldn't use in 1991 was 1,000 times less powerful than an iPhone or an iPad today. But I can hand an iPad to my 3-year-old granddaughter and she can pretty much figure out the UI in a matter of minutes.
That's true, yeah.
And so we have come a long way.
Yeah. And so have the kids. I mean, they've grown up with this. I want to talk a little bit about it's an interesting transition. You fell in love with journalism at a very early age, but you became, as you mentioned, a computer hobbyist, kind of in the middle. And I really identify with that remark because it was very similar for me. Except I fell in love with radio and became a hobbyist, and we both were able to translate our hobbies into our careers.
Yeah.
I want to know about those transitions. We'll get to that in a second. Walt Mossberg, the Dean of American Tech Journalism, is our guest, and it's a thrill to have him on Triangulation today. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. I think it could be safe to say the WordPress is the Dean of American, worldwide blogging and website software. In fact, at this point, they're dominant. 28% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress, including some of the biggest journalistic platforms. Quartz runs on WordPress. My blog, I've been using WordPress. I think I started using it in the early 2000s. I was hosting it myself for a long time because I thought, dumb me, I need to know all about, you know, how to run a blog, how to run WordPress, how to run a server. But I found I spent so much time maintaining the server that I didn't really blog as much as I oughta. WordPress.com takes all that burden off of you. They host your site. They do all the security updates and patches automatically, so you don't have to worry about it. You can worry about your content. You don't have to be a web expert at WordPress.com. You just go to WordPress.com, click the Get Started button. You see right here, you start with two simple templates. You get to either do a blog or a website. You pick the one you want, and you'll be up and running in minutes. But then all the fun begins because you can choose from hundreds of templates and looks and feel. The content is completely separate from the design, so you keep writing. You keep putting stuff up there. You keep posting articles and pictures and whatever. But when you change the design, it changes automatically. So you can play with it. You can have fun with it. You don't even need to hire somebody to run your WordPress blog. I swear to you, no matter how unfamiliar you are with this, you can do it yourself. Your business needs a blog. It needs a website. These days, it's like... In the old days, if you didn't have a Yellow Pages ad, you couldn't be in business. But today, even if you're a plumber or a candlestick maker, you need to have a website. Anytime I use a business, first thing I do, I go to their website. Make it easy on yourself. Make it better for your customers with WordPress.com. You're also joining a lively community that can help you make your site better. They can drive traffic to your site. The WordPress.com front page is huge, and people get a lot of traffic from the front page automatically. Since I went back to WordPress.com, I've 500,000 followers on there. That's remarkable. WordPress.com/triangulation. If you go there right now, you can get started very easy. And if you decide to buy a plan, any new plan purchase, 15% off. WordPress.com/triangulation. Oh, by the way, if you do want to hire somebody, because WordPress has been around for so long and so well supported, the API is the definitive API for website content management systems. There's plenty of consultants out there who can help you. The world is your oyster at WordPress.com, but you got to get started right now. WordPress.com/triangulation. Walt Mossberg is our guest today on Triangulation. Really a pleasure to have him on. He recently wrote his last column in June for Vox. He'd been at Wall Street Journal for many, many years, starting in 1991. But I was reading a biography. You fell in love with journalism in high school. And this was the thing that surprised me. Your buddy, James Woods, fell in love with journalism. You two wrote a column together?
Yes. So I grew up in a suburb of Providence, Rhode Island.
Another commonality, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. You were in Warwick.
I was in Warwick. Yeah, there we go. How could we never have met?
I know, it's bizarre. We've been parallel tracks this whole time.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
So my best friend in high school was Jimmy Woods, who later became a well-regarded Hollywood actor. And the Providence Journal at the time decided to run these columns written by high school students about what was going on at their high school. Now, these were highly censored columns, censored by the English department at the high school. And so they were very boring.
Right.
But you got your little picture on it and your name. And at my high school, Woods and I wrote it together for about a month. And I say about a month because he was much more interested in acting in the school plays and so forth. And so he dropped out of it and I kept doing it alone. But yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
And is that when you kind of fell in love with this whole idea of writing a column?
Yeah, it was. I used to have to take my copy, which was, of course, typed on paper, and go down to the Providence Journal. Took the bus down there, and you know, I was exposed to the newsroom and to editors who would gently edit this thing. And then I won. Somebody had neglected to tell me this even existed, but it turned out there was a prize for the best one of these high school columns, and I won it. And the prize was you got to go to the Northwestern University Journalism School in the summer, where they ran a program for high school kids, and you got to just immerse yourself in journalism for about 8 weeks, and that just sealed the deal, the two things. And then I came back, and I was a copy boy, and I was a summer reporter. They didn't really have an intern program, but you know, when people would be on vacation, they'd send me to, you know, the West Warwick Bureau or, the police beat downtown for a week.
Not the Warwick Bureau, the West Warwick.
The West Warwick, and as you know, West Warwick is much smaller. Even
yes,
they weren't going to send me to the Warwick Bureau.
But that's how you start out in newspapers, right? You start at the very bottom.
I mean, since you're from Rhode Island, I'll tell you. I mean, it was the Arctic Bureau, really, which is for those who don't know, which is most everyone. That was just the name for the downtown area of West Warwick, and it was a storefront on a street. The police officer walking the beat would come by and come in the door and gossip with us, and you know, we would really know everyone in the town. And we had five police radios because we had five towns we were responsible for covering. And if there was an accident on the highway or some kind of disturbance somewhere or whatever, one of us would rush out to cover it. And you know, I learned a lot. I covered town council meetings, I covered zoning board meetings, and those are serious political business in Rhode Island, even in little towns. And really, I discovered years later, not very much different than covering Senate committees in Washington.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So I learned a lot.
I worry that the newspapers, you know, at the time, the Providence Journal was the morning paper. You also had the evening bulletin, the evening paper.
Right.
Every town had a morning and an afternoon paper. And now, if you're lucky, you have a paper. The Providence Journal still running, but so many newspapers going out of business. And I wonder where the next generation of Walt Mossbrooks is going to come from. Are people covering city council meetings anymore? I doubt it.
Well, the next generation of Walt Mossbrooks will be robots, I'm pretty sure.
I think you might be right. You don't remember what the subject of that first high school column that won the award was, do you?
No, well, it was the body of work that won the award.
Okay.
We're all horribly boring,
your Irv got the award.
Yeah, my Irv got the award, and they were very boring.
The first of many, I might add, including a lifetime Loeb Award, which is pretty impressive. Congratulations!
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, so you fall in love with journalism. You go to college for journalism. You went to URI?
No.
I went to Brandeis. That's right. Yeah.
I actually got an honorary doctorate from URI years later,
right.
Which was very nice of them. And
why Brandeis?
Because it was not in Providence.
it was in New Jersey.
it's in Boston, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It's in,
okay.
Waltham, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston.
Like 15 minutes away.
Well, it's about an hour away from Warwick. I got into Brown, and I got into Brandeis, and I got into a few other places, including URI and some other places. But it really came down to Brown versus Brandeis. My parents really wanted me to go to Brown, which is located in Providence and is in the Ivy League. And I preferred going to Boston and going to Brandeis, and it worked out well. I really got a great education there. I was involved in the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War movement there. I met my wife. I met my best friend, who's still my best friend. And so college was great. And while there, I worked on the college paper. I continued to work summers in Providence, and I was a stringer for the New York Times.
Oh, now we're talking.
So the journalism continued.
Yeah, yeah. Did you study journalism at Brandeis?
No, they didn't have it.
Yeah.
They didn't have it as a major. And I asked somebody, I was so bitten by the journalism bug that I asked somebody at Northwestern, should I withdraw my acceptance of going to Brandeis and could I quickly get into Northwestern? And these grad students who were running this high school summer program I was in said, that would be a huge mistake. You should go to Brandeis. You should do journalism in the school paper and elsewhere, but you should take as many courses as you can as an undergrad in subjects that are about the real world. So I majored in what was called at Brandeis politics, which other places call political science. And I took economics and history and sociology and art and, you know, whatever I could take to try to get, educated in a lot of different things.
And that was probably a very good decision, I think.
Well, that was, yeah, I thank those journalism grad students in Chicago for giving me that advice.
Yeah.
So thank you if you're watching this, listening to this.
You made the right choice. Obviously, you made the right choice. So you're writing, you're covering politics. You get a job in Detroit, right? Was that the Times?
It was the Journal.
The Journal.
The Journal hired me. Right. I went. What happened was I left. I graduated Brandeis, and I got accepted to the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism in New York at Columbia University, and after that one-year program, I had a master's, and the Wall Street Journal hired me. And I come from a family that is not a family of business people. And in fact, in my immediate family, I was the first one to go to college. And I never had seen a stock certificate or an annual corporate report, and nobody in our family read the Wall Street Journal. But they hired me, and I wanted to work for a national paper. And the New York Times offered me a job that was sort of a clerk job, and I didn't want that. And the Washington Post offered me a local reporting job, and I didn't want that because I had done it in Providence. And so I went to the Wall Street Journal, and I said, I want to work in Washington. And they said, well, we don't send people we hire out of school right to Washington. So you have to go to one of our other bureaus, and they sent me to Detroit, which my wife and I were both unhappy about because we thought because we had never really lived off the East Coast, the Northeast, and also because, you know, Detroit was in our minds not a great place. But that was a mistake on our part. Detroit turned out to be great both in terms of both of our careers. She was a learning disabilities teacher at the time, and it also turned out to be great. We met great people, and so I'm very glad I went to Detroit for just under 4 years, and then the Journal transferred me to Washington.
That's the job you really wanted because you love politics, right? That's
yeah. Well, I started as the national labor reporter, one of them. We had two of them in Washington. And from there, when you're covering labor, you're also covering politics because of the fact that organized labor is very involved in politics. And then I got to cover a whole bunch of other things like energy, environment, the Pentagon. I was the chief Pentagon reporter. I spent a stint as the deputy bureau chief. I covered international economics, and then I covered national security just before I started the tech thing. And somewhere around the time I was the Pentagon reporter, I was in a drugstore in D.C., and in a bin, they had these computers for $99 each. These were Timex Sinclair 1000s.
And worth every penny.
Worth every penny, Leo. You remember that computer?
Oh, yeah.
it had a sort of
plastic
membrane keyboard.
Yeah.
And on the keys, they had embedded basic commands. In addition to the letters and numbers, there were actual basic commands on the keys. Had 1K of RAM, and you could buy a module that plugged into it that raised the total memory to 16K, and that was another $99, and I eventually bought that. And all of your software, all of the programs either that you bought to run on it or that you wrote and wanted to save, had to be done on cassette tapes. You bought a cassette player at Radio Shack and you used that. So, right. And it took five minutes.
And it failed five half minutes. The time.
Exactly. It took 5 minutes to load 5K of material, and you had to do it again and again. Because if you dropped a bit,
it's all over.
And it was the song you were playing, which right. was the real purpose of the Radio Shack cassette player. You could drop a bit in a song and it wouldn't matter. Your ear couldn't hear it. But if you dropped a bit on a program, the program wouldn't run. So, yeah, you had to keep redoing it and redoing it.
But something happened with that Timex Sinclair. You fell in love with this
thing. I did.
Thing.
It was like magic, and I actually learned BASIC on that. And then I saved up a bunch of money, and it was a bunch of money. It was $3,000 all in. And I bought an Apple IIe.
Mm.
And that was about 83 or 4, something like that. Just before the Mac came out.
Yeah.
Of course, it had BASIC, which I later found out was BASIC supplied by Microsoft. It was called AppleSoft BASIC, as you may remember.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many years later, I got Steve Jobs and Bill Gates to tell a story of that. And I continued to learn BASIC. That was the last coding I ever did, though. And the Apple IIe really was, I mean, the difference between that and the Timex was enormous. And, put more memory into it to go buy memory chips. You had to put them in one at a time. I always had to buy one extra one because I would bend the pins or impale my thumb right. on the chip, whatever. And
Think you could make that your career? I mean, reason I started writing about computers was because I needed somebody to afford this stuff. It was so damn expensive that, you know, that was really more to support my habit than it was because I wanted to be a tech writer.
Yeah, no, I didn't think about it being my career. Look, I was the chief Pentagon reporter.
You were doing great. Yeah.
A very big newspaper. Yeah. And it wasn't like I was rich, but I had a salary. I ran up a lot of credit card debt, much to my wife's concern, buying this computer stuff. Because I also, then I bought a Mac and I bought a DOS computer and I had a lot of stuff. And my kids were learning it with me, and it was, you know, it was kind of a thing. And it went on for about 10 years. And I joined user groups, and I wrote a few freelance pieces in computer magazines, mostly Apple magazines. There was a magazine, I want to say, it was called A+. Is that right?
Yep.
I wrote something in there, and I actually wrote one computer piece in the Wall Street Journal because they asked me to, because by then it had become known that I knew something about computers, and a lot of others at the paper and most papers didn't. And but I was serious, you know, I was serious about the Washington stuff, and this was my hobby. And then around 1990, as I already mentioned, I decided I wanted to do this computer column. And there were a number of reasons, but one of them was I thought computers, which at that time were still not super widespread, were about to become democratized, and they were still way too hard to use. And I thought, well, why don't I write a column where I'm doing what I said earlier, you know, where I'm helping people, explaining it, not using jargon, criticizing the industry, so forth. And so it led to that. But at the beginning with the Timex and the Apple II, it was a hobby. I wasn't thinking about doing that for a career.
Did you, so you're writing the column, did you consciously say I should be talking about products as opposed to writing help pieces?
Well, I did both. I did mostly I did product reviews. I did three kinds of things. The vast, vast majority were product reviews. Then there were two other kinds of things. There were some how-tos and help pieces. For instance, when a new version of Windows would come out, I would review it. But I would also do how to upgrade to Windows 98 or whatever it was from Windows 95, so forth. And in the course of doing that how-to piece, I would also criticize Microsoft if I thought it was too hard. And I would explain what you would lose, because you would sometimes lose things. Some apps wouldn't work in the upgrade, and what you would gain as well. And then the third kind of piece would be commentary. Sometimes I would just let loose and like attack the cell phone carriers or attack Microsoft or Intel or somebody, you know.
Do you remember the first time you spoke to Steve Jobs?
Yes, I was. It was before I had my column, but I wasn't covering him. Because he was at Next.
He had already left, been fired at Apple.
Oh, yeah. I was not, let me make it clear. I was not on the computer beat in 1977, 1980 or 81 when, or 84 when the Mac was introduced. And I was not on the computer beat when Windows was introduced or any of that stuff. But I was a hobbyist, as we've already discussed. And I was... So I started my column, and he was at Next, but Next was a company that sold $10,000 computers to engineers and graduate students, and that did not fit my target audience in my mind. So I didn't call him up, and I didn't ever go there or know anything about it. But I was at a party in Silicon Valley, and he was there, and he came over to me, introduced himself, said that he liked my column. And I said, well, you know, I've used your computers and I like them. And we chatted for maybe 15 minutes. And that was the first time I met him until he came back to Apple in 97.
You ended up having actually very direct personal relationship with Steve Jobs. In fact, you've written very movingly about visiting him essentially on his deathbed. So how did that relationship develop?
Well, he came back to Apple. It was a mess, as you know. I think it was 60 or 90 days from bankruptcy. And all of a sudden, the phone rang at my house on a Sunday night, Sunday evening, Eastern time. And it was him. And just like you, just like any other veteran journalist, I understood that he was calling me partly for PR reasons and for, you know, his company was in trouble and he needed to get the word out that he was going to rescue it and that things were going to be different and so forth. But, and I had been pretty pro Apple because it was the easiest computer to use through the first part of my career writing the column. But very recently, before he took over, maybe 6 months before, I'd written a column saying, don't buy a Mac anymore.
Wow.
Because
nobody remembers that.
Well,
wow.
Our friend Dan Gilmore in the San Jose Mercury News actually wrote a story. He wrote a column about my writing that column. And so Jobs calls my house on a Sunday night and he starts, you know, giving me his spiel. He was a hell of a sales guy, as you know, hell of a marketer. But it turned into more of an hour and a half conversation about what he was going to do. And, you know, we got to gossiping about the industry and different trends and different things. And then he started calling every Sunday night for about 4 or 5 weeks to the point where, I mean, the first call, my wife was like, it's Steve Jobs on the phone. By the third call, it was like, it's Steve Jobs on the phone. You know, here's goes our Sunday night. And these were all about hour and a half, maybe longer conversations. Wow. Wow. And that was the start of our relationship. But I want to quickly say that I think that's pretty well known that I had this relationship with him. But I spent essentially as much time talking to Bill Gates, not through phone calls like that, but by visiting Redmond or by him being in D.C. or us together being at CES or email or whatever. There were lots and lots of conversations. There were dinners and there were meetings, and he was very generous with his time with me. And, you know, I just interviewed him about a year ago at our conference. So
do you remember
I
your
also
first
had a relationship with him?
Do you remember your first conversation with Bill Gates?
I do. This happened earlier than my first long conversation with Jobs. So this would have been in 91, probably. I started my column in 91, and a couple of months later, so maybe December, he comes through D.C. for some other reason, not to see me, but he agreed to see me. I found out he was coming to D.C., and I asked to see him, or possibly they invited me to see him. I don't remember the details. And we met up in some hotel. And the first thing after hello that he said to me was, where did you come from?
What did he mean by that?
I'll tell you what he meant by that. So Bill Gates prided himself on knowing every tech reporter.
Yeah.
And most of the tech reporters, many of whom did a very good job, I want to stress that, for the audience they were writing for, which was techies and enthusiasts. And they themselves were techies and enthusiasts. Some of them came out of the industry. These were people at PC Magazine and PC Week and InfoWorld and all of these publications, which some of the people watching or listening to this have no idea what I'm talking about, but
oh no, everybody
know.
Watching, I think, probably does know.
Okay, so PC
we're talking
World,
to geeks.
I can go on. You know, yeah. There are a lot of them.
Yeah,
and a computer shopper. I mean, you know, all these,
yeah. And we know, and all these guys we know. Yeah,
and we know all these guys, yeah. and many of them were fine journalists, but they were writing in sort of a trade environment. They were writing, it was exciting and it was technical, and they were using jargon and their readers were understanding the jargon, and all of that was perfectly fine. And I was very different. So he knew all those people. And right. By the way, in 1991, it was a limited number, nothing like now.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
You could absolutely know everybody. Yeah.
Were there 100 people or important tech reporters?
Right.
Were there
not even that many? Yeah.
27. I don't know how many there were, but he knew them all.
Right.
And so, but he didn't know me. And I was different in several ways. One is I wasn't out of the industry or out of the trades. And so I wasn't part of that. I was writing for a different audience. I was 44 years old. And that was a lot older than most of these others.
Older than Bill, and, even.
Yeah, I was older than Bill.
Yeah.
And I was a Washington-trained journalist. Now, I'm not going to say that none of the others were, but probably most of the others weren't. And so I was just different in all those vectors. And, you know, Bill was an educated man and a person interested in more than just computing. And he read the Wall Street Journal every morning in print very thoroughly. And so I was right there in his face every once a week, you know, every Thursday. And where did you come from was the appropriate question, I think. And so I answered it and we talked about it.
You, of course, your relationship with both Bill and Steve is legendary. But it, well, for instance, you did not move to Silicon Valley when you started writing the personal technology column.
Yes.
You stayed in Washington, D.C.
Yes. There's a story there, too.
Well, tell me.
So Norm Perlstein, the editor who had been my backer and my booster and fought the war inside the journal, let me have the column. Once it was secure and I was about to start the column, which was in October of 91, he said to me, we'll move you to Palo Alto and we'll cover it. This was the days when newspapers had money. He said, we'll move you to Palo Alto. We'll pay your moving costs. We'll make up any difference between what your house in D.C. costs and what a house there costs. Now, houses there were not anything like they cost now, but there might have been a difference. I don't know. D.C. is also a high price market.
In 91, you could have moved to Silicon Valley pretty cheaply.
Yeah.
Wouldn't
but he made this whole offer to me, and I said, no. And he said, what do you mean? How are you going to see all the new products and review them and see them in advance and all that? And I said, look, here's the reason I don't want to move. If I move, I will get sucked into the industry. I will get sucked into the culture. I will be, because remember, I was not a reporter. I was going to be a critic.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be a critic. And so I said, it's just going to be harder to be a critic of products made by people I see at the PTA meeting.
Right.
I see at the Safeway.
Right.
I see on the street. It's much better for me to be able to maintain a consumer point of view on the other coast. I also said, it's the Wall Street Journal. It's never before had a tech critic. If we announce we're going to have a tech critic, people will come and show me the products. Whether I'm in Washington, whether I'm in Des Moines, wherever I am, they will. Plus, I promised him I would go to the Valley, you know, 5 or 6 times a year, which I did over all those 26 years.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of trips.
Yeah, no kidding.
And go to Redmond and go to Austin to see Dell and go to Raleigh to see the IBM ThinkPad group, later Lenovo, and go to Boston to see certain companies. You know, I went wherever I had to go.
So the reason I ask that is at the same time, you're becoming friends with Steve Jobs and to a lesser extent, Bill Gates. You knew, you said it, that Steve was probably cultivating you. How do you keep them at arm's length and yet become friends and do your job?
Well, it's just sort of journalism 101, right? I mean, I'm sure you've had to do it too.
Yeah, I don't even go anywhere near them. That's my motto. I don't want to talk to CEOs.
I was not friends with either of them in the sense that we socialized.
Okay.
I never socialized.
So you didn't feel any personal pressure, you know? Steve would call you if you said something negative.
Well, I'm going to tell you. So, it depends on your definition of friends. I mean, I had conversations with both of them one-on-one, even without PR people at some times. Other times PR people were there or other executives. And we talked about tech and we talked about other things because they were very curious about Washington, and I knew something about Washington, and I was curious about things that they knew about that I didn't know about. So it went beyond just a structured interview, but our wives didn't meet.
Right.
We didn't go out to, you know, I think I went out to dinner. I never went out to dinner with Jobs. I went out to dinner once with Gates, and which is an interesting story in itself. But so
was he a messy eater?
No, but he took me to dinner at an Indian restaurant in a strip mall in Redmond or Bellevue, and the door to the restaurant was in the back of the mall of the shopping center, and he liked it because nobody bothered him
right.
there. And we spent hours there. And by the way, he drove – traffic on 520 was very bad, and so he drove half the way to the restaurant on the shoulder. He didn't have a driver. He was driving himself in this Lexus.
He drove on the shoulder.
Yeah. Not the whole way. Not the whole
– I'm not surprised. Why am I not surprised at all?
And, you know, Jobs, as you know, also, when you're talking about driving, Jobs didn't ever had license plates.
No.
On his car.
No.
And I saw the car a couple of times, and sure enough, no license plates, plenty of tickets. So the way that I, you know, I just wrote what I believe to be true.
Yeah.
I tended to favor... Not always, but most of the time I tended to favor Apple products because Apple was making products directly for consumers. They were not making products for intermediaries. They were not making products for the IT department. They were not making products when they got to be making phones. They were not making phones for the carriers. They were making phones for the user. So the person that bought their product was, in their mind and in reality, going to be the person that used the product. Microsoft and many other companies did make consumer products, but they would use the phrase end user to refer to the consumer. I never heard that phrase at Apple. And that phrase was meant to encapsulate the idea that the product was being sold to an IT person or a carrier who was selling it to you, and they were, and that was their real customer.
Mm.
And so that there was a difference between the customer and the user. Whereas at Apple, there wasn't any difference between the customer and the user for the most part. Sure, they sold the school systems, and eventually they sold the IT people who would then give it out to the people in the company. But that's not how they designed the products or why they did things. And so I tended to favor Apple products, but it didn't mean that I didn't have fights with Jobs. Jobs would call me, and he would say, after I wrote a review of something, and he would say, well, I'm not calling to complain about your column. And that meant I'm calling to complain about your column. And so the way he would construct the conversation is he would say, I really liked the column. It was really fair and really right on about this and that and that. But this part of the column here, I don't understand why you said this. This is completely wrong. And, you know, then he would say, sometimes yell at me, and I would yell back at him. And Bill, the same thing. We had yelling, I mean, real yelling, hand-waving arguments on more than one occasion about things I'd written. Bill had a photographic memory, or either that or he was super well prepared. I would see him every, you know, maybe twice a year or three times a year. And he would remember every column I'd written between these visits. And he would, and I had invited him to do this when I first met him. I said, you know, I'm going to be criticizing you. You should feel free to criticize me. And he took it to heart. And in between meetings, he would go over every column, even if it wasn't about Microsoft. He would say, well, that column was right on. I like that one.
Wow.
This one was all wrong. You were way off base. I don't know why you thought this was right. or this one was, this part of it was good and this part of it was bad, and it was about Microsoft, then it would get kind of personal, and we would get into a yelling match. And I think I have a, I never can prove this, Leo, but I think these were not people who were yelled at a lot.
No.
Who had a lot of pushback from the people that work for them. And I didn't work for them, so I pushed back.
And I have to say, I think it's a measure of their respect for you, and I think they appreciated it. They certainly can't not talk to you. I mean, by this point, you wield such power in the industry that even if they said, "I hate that Walt Mossberg," they're never going to say, you know, "I hate you, Walt Mossberg."
Some people didn't talk to me. There were some CEOs. Not the two of them, but there were some other CEOs that tried to get me fired.
Really?
And to the great credit of the editors of the Wall Street Journal, they tended to tell me these stories about people coming in to try to get me fired months after this had happened. Mm-hmm. And of course, they always refused to fire me. The first one that sticks in my mind to this day was, there was a service, and I know you'll remember it, and if you say geeks listen to this, then they'll all remember it. There was a service called Prodigy.
Oh, yeah.
This is pre-web. It was the biggest, or it was roughly tied with CompuServe to be the biggest online service. And I wrote a column attacking them and saying that this scruffy little barely known service called America Online was the better service.
Steve Case said you made America Online a success.
Well, what he said was I helped turbocharge their success. And that was the column that he's referring to.
Yeah.
And at the time I wrote that column, which was sometime in early 92 maybe, Prodigy had about 2 million subscribers and AOL had about 200,000. And the head of Prodigy, which was, for those who don't remember, was owned by IBM and Sears. Mm-hmm. It was like everything Sears knew about technology and everything IBM knew about retail.
And, beautiful merger.
And they marched into the journal, or the CEO and a couple of his aides marched into the journal, saw the editor, and demanded that I be fired summarily, and noted that they, both IBM and Sears, advertised in the journal,
right?
And particularly IBM, and you know, they were told that I was not going to be fired, I wasn't fired.
This is really important. Maybe something that doesn't exist as much anymore, but you were insulated. You had a firewall between you and ad sales, and the journal respected that.
Yes. I never heard from the sales department pro or con. I never heard, "Oh my God, that's so great. We sold a bunch of ads because of what you wrote," or "Please don't write this ad criticizing IBM because they'll pull, you know, their ads," right, or whatever. The journal had this strong code of ethics about that at the time. Once in a while, the ad department would ask me to appear at an event and speak about tech, and I would do it on the grounds, on the condition that no sales took place during the event. But of course, it was all part of a sales process.
But you weren't compensated by those companies.
Oh, no.
No.
I took nothing.
Yeah.
I took no trips. I took no free products. I took no expenses. I took no free dinner. I took nothing.
No tech stocks. I mean, this.
No, I own no tech stocks, and I own no tech mutual funds. In fact, I'm, now that I'm retired, literally 2 days ago, like on Friday, this is being recorded on a Monday. So just a few days ago, I bought a few tech stocks for the first time since 1990.
What did you 91. Buy? Now everybody wants to know.
No, I'm not going to talk about that.
Was it a big company, a new company, up-and-coming company?
Not talking about it at all.
See, you know, you still wield immense power. You very famously were able to get the All Things D conference became and still is the place where the biggest names in tech would come and speak. You very famously got Steve Jobs and Bill Gates to join you and Kara on stage. That was quite a coup. All of us were going, wow.
Yeah. So,
and a great interview, by the way. They were
great. Thank you.
You getting them together was massive because their relationship became clear in a way that we really never had known.
Yeah, I compare it to ex-presidents, and I'm serious when I say this. So this was in 2007. It was exactly 30 years from the launch of the Apple II, which along with the Commodore PET and the Radio Shack TRS-80 in 1977 were the first kind of mass market computers. And as I mentioned before, Microsoft had some software in that Apple II, the basic programming language that was included in there was theirs. And so they had worked together in 1977, and then again they worked together on the Mac in 1984, but they were also fierce competitors. I had heard them both in off-the-record private conversations being very nasty about each other. And but they, like ex-presidents who run against each other and say nasty things, they were 30 years in, they were still running big successful tech companies, and there were not very many other people who had been around in 77 who were still running these companies in 2007.
Yeah.
So who were they going to, you know, they even said, if you watch the interview, at one point, I think Gates said, I kind of miss, I'm glad to be talking to you because I kind of miss having more people who were around then.
Yeah.
Still around now to talk to.
Yeah.
And so they had this multi-layered relationship of bitter competitiveness, but also having been collaborators at the beginning. And the interview, first of all, it was a miracle to me that they agreed to the interview. I set it up, and they were both sort of amazed that each other was willing to do it if the other one would do it. So they agreed. And their PR people, their chief PR people, supported it and were helpful. And it almost fell apart in the green room about an hour and a half before it started.
But really?
Yes.
What happened?
Because, well, so the deal that we struck for them to do the interview was they agreed to do the interview, which was an evening interview, but they said, both of them, by the way, had spoken individually at our conference in the past. And they said, I offered as a sweetener to throw in that they could each have a block, an interview, a segment in the conference by themselves if they wanted. And then they would do this joint thing at night. And so they both accepted. Microsoft, Bill Gates had announced his retirement, but it was still 18 months off or a year off. So he was still CEO, but they were interested in building up Steve Ballmer. So they gave their block, their individual block, to Steve Ballmer, and he came on stage in the afternoon of that day or the day before, I don't remember, and he was interviewed. And at Apple, there was only one person who was ever allowed in those days to represent the company at a conference like this, and that was Steve. So Steve appeared separately with me a few hours before the big joint appearance. And during that interview, this was not – you have to understand, these were all unrehearsed interviews. They understood the big themes, but we never told them the questions. And it just occurred to me on the spot that – because of iTunes, Apple was one of the biggest developers on the Windows platform, which was a bizarre thing. And so I just said to him, and he did not know this question was coming. I just said to him, "What?" I said, "You know, iTunes is now on hundreds of millions of Windows computers. What does it feel like to be one of the biggest developers of Windows software? How odd is that? What does it feel like? And he instantly got this devilish grin on his face and said to me, it feels like giving a glass of ice water to a person in hell.
Oh.
Now, Gates was not there yet. He was flying in on his jet for the evening joint appearance. But his PR person was there, and he was horrified.
Yeah.
So he had to go meet Gates' jet when it landed, and he met Gates' jet, and he briefed him on everything that happened at the conference. But particularly, Gates wanted to know about the Steve Jobs interview. And, of course, he had to tell him that Steve had said this. And so an hour and a half before the joint interview, we had agreed to a meeting in the green room, which we never did with other interviews. But this was an extraordinary moment, and we wanted to just get them comfortable and, you know, whatever. And so Gates walks into the green room, and he's pissed. He's pissed. And Jobs walks in 5 minutes late with a big grin on his face. And the only staff they had with him were their absolute chief PR people at the two companies, Katie Cotton for Apple and Larry Cohen for Microsoft. And the two PR people were very worried. Gates was giving monosyllabic answers. And Jobs strolls in, grabs a bottle of one of those plastic water bottles out of an ice bucket that was in the green room, sits down on a chair, and Gates says, well, I guess I'm the representative of hell at this conference.
Oh, ow.
And Jobs said nothing but just handed him a bottle of ice cold with the frost still on it, you know, the thing from the bucket. And Gates cracked up, and everybody and the PR people were like, oh my God, I'm so relieved. And the whole tension broke. And, you know, we said to them, look, because when I was setting up the interview, they both said, well, we want this to be a high level kind of, we want to be statesmen of the industry in this interview. And I said, look, it's up to you. I'm not giving you the questions. You're going to have to figure out. If you want to have a big fight on the stage, it's great for us as conference producers. We're fine. If you want to be statesmen on the stage, that's even better for us. That's what we would like. But if you want to have it devolve into a giant argument, that's okay too. It's up to you. And luckily, they were statesmen on the stage. They were not. They did not get into a cat fight or anything like that on the stage.
I think Bill was used to pot shots from Steve. Steve famously said, you have no taste. And
yeah.
Bill was always kind of the adult and said, oh, there goes Steve.
But Bill sort of preempted it because Steve was actually, Kara asked them, what did they admire the most in each other?
Yeah.
In each other's contribution
great
to the industry.
Yeah.
And Steve said, well, I admire that Bill was the first person to think of software as a standalone product, that you could build a company around just software. And he was right. And it was the heart of everything. And I admire that. And I think it was a great thing. And Bill said, I admire Steve's taste. I wish that we had had the kind of taste and sense that Steve Jobs had in his company had and Apple had in building this stuff. So in a way, he preempted. There was no pot shot coming from Steve on that question after Bill Gates said that.
But it was also acknowledgement, you know, that, yeah, you might have been right, Steve. you did have great
and
taste.
And at another point in the interview, Steve, because we asked, well, what were your, you know, what do you wish you had done better? And I don't remember what Bill said, but I do remember that Steve said, I wish we had partnered better.
Yeah,
Woz and I always thought we had to make the whole banana,
right,
the whole widget ourselves. And we weren't always very good partners. And And then he pointed to Bill and he said, whereas those guys understood how to partner much better than we did.
There is no way Steve Jobs was ever partnering with anybody. And if he was, then he was the senior partner by far.
Yeah, well, he learned to partner better. I mean, what I think a lot of people don't understand and don't give him enough credit for was he became a much more mature, much better manager in his second phase.
Yes.
And if he hadn't been, that company would not have soared the way it did. And all those great people wouldn't have worked for him.
Right. Yeah, absolutely true. He called you very close to the end of his life and you spent some time with him.
So I'll tell you the story. I remember the date. It was August 24th of 2011, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He stepped down. That was the day he stepped down as CEO. And he stepped down as CEO because he knew that the end was near. I don't think he knew how near it was, but he knew it was relatively near. He just couldn't. You will remember that he had taken a couple of medical leaves. He'd been down, and then he'd pop back up to where he had enough energy to operate as CEO, and then he would drop back down again. It was this up and down thing. It was a very difficult few years for Apple. Tim Cook had functioned as CEO for 3 months, 4 months, whatever it was during several of these episodes. Other times, even when he was back as CEO, back from these leaves, he would be running the company from his home. He wouldn't come into the office very much. And eventually it became clear to him and to the board that it was really time for him to step down as CEO. So he did. And the editors of the journal and my own, just me and Kara as the editors of the All Things D website, we wanted some kind of essay and I was asked to write it. So I'm sitting there at about 6:30 at night Eastern, pounding away, writing this essay. And it was really that essay. He was still alive. He was still going to be chairman. So it wasn't really an essay about Steve Jobs, the man. It was because he was stepping down as CEO, I chose to write an essay about just step back. It sort of was saying step back for a minute and realize the phenomenal run of game-changing products that have come out during his career, and particularly since he came back to Apple, and all the industries had changed. I'm writing away at this, and the phone rings, and it's him. And he says to me, I just want you to know, even though I stepped down as CEO, I'm not going to be inactive in the company. I'm going to focus on a couple of things, principally television. And I think we've got something really cool. I think we figured it out. I think we've got something really cool. And when are you coming to the Valley next? And I said, well, I'll come anytime if you want, but I had, you know, probably in another, I could be there in a couple weeks if you want. And he said, no, that's too soon. But if you come in a few months, I think I'll have something to show you, you know, NDA that I think will blow your mind. And I said, great, I'll come. And, you know, we chatted for a few more minutes. I told him what I was doing. He said, well, you better get back to work or something. And he hung up and I finished this piece, never mentioning this conversation because it was off the record. And the essay ran. And I had every intention of going out and seeing this television project in a few months. But he died 6 weeks later. And I never saw it. I don't know what it was. I don't know. It's a mystery.
Yeah, Walter Isaacson quotes him as saying, we licked it.
Yeah, we cracked the code.
It's still a mystery. Whatever it was, I don't think it was the Apple TV. I just don't think we ever saw whatever it was.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah. I think we're going to have to end the interview at that point because I have so many more things I want to talk with you about, but I don't want to take too much of your time. Walt Mossberg is a living legend, the dean of tech journalism, and we are all better for it, I think.
Thank you.
You deny credit, but I think you can take a lot of credit for making computing more accessible, easier, for moving companies in the right direction. And I do hope that whatever you do in retirement, we still get to hear from your unique voice. Thank you, Walt, for joining us today.
Thank you, Leo.
Walt Mossberg. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. I'd love you to join us. Watch the show live if you can at twit.tv/live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. We call it Triangulation because, well, there's three legs to this stool. There's me, my guest, and then you and your contributions through the chat room. So if you can watch it live, do. But I know many of you like to watch on demand at your convenience. Many of you are watching on airplanes or listening on airplanes today. You can get the show anytime, twit.tv/TRI. That's where we keep it on our website. Or subscribe, whatever you use to get podcasts. You'll find us, Triangulation. Subscribe and get it every single week. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time on Triangulation.